Side 5. The Difference Engine by William Gibson and Bruce Sterling. Continuing on page 154. So, what was it to be? This giant iron vase with octagonal base, with 8 openwork screens hanging before its fluted pedestal, giving a singular lightness and elegance to the entire object? This carved boxwood bracket with sculpted canopy, the intended mounting of a Venetian glass thermometer. This ebony salt cellar, enriched with columns and elaborate sunken panels, accompanied by a silver salt spoon, rich with trefoils, oak leaves, a spiral-girded stem, and the monogram of one's choice. Within J. Walker and Company, a small but marvelously tasteful establishment amid the bay-windowed shops of the famed arcade, Mallory discovered a gift that seemed to him perfectly apt. It was an 8-day clock which struck the quarters and hours on fine cathedral-toned bells. The timepiece, which also displayed the date, the day of the week, and the phases of the moon, was an outstanding piece of British precision craftsmanship, though naturally the elegant clock stand would claim more admiration from the mechanically undiscerning. The stand, of the finest lacquered papier-mâché, inlaid with turquoise-blue glass, was surmounted by a group of large gilt figures. These represented a young and decidedly attractive Britannia, very lightly robed, admiring the progress made by time and science in the civilization and happiness of the people of Britain. This laudable theme was additionally illustrated by a series of 7 graven scenes, revolving weekly on hidden gearwork within the clock's base. The price was nothing less than 14 guineas. It seemed that an item of this artistic rarity could not be denominated in simple pounds, shillings, and pence. The crass pragmatic thought struck Mallory that the happy couple might be better served with a jingling handful of 14 guineas. But the money would soon go, as money always did when one was young. A fine clock like this one might adorn one's home for generations. Mallory bought the clock with cash, refusing the offer of credit with a year to pay. The clerk, a supercilious elderly man, sweating into a starched Regency collar, demonstrated the system of cork chocks that secured the gearwork from the exigencies of travel. The clock was provided with a latched and handled case, lined with form-fitting cork under burgundy velvet. Mallory knew he could never wedge his prize into a crowded steam bus. He would have to hire another cabriolet and lash the clock case to its roof. A bothersome proposition, London being haunted by the young thieves known as dragsmen, monkey-like rascals who leapt with saw-toothed dirks onto the roofs of passing carriages to cut the leather straps securing luggage. By the time the cab pulled to a stop, the thieves would have scampered scot-free into the depths of some evil rookery, passing their swag from hand to hand until the private contents of the victim's valise ended up in a dozen rag-and-bone shops. Mallory lugged his purchase through the far gate of the Burlington Arcade, where the constable on guard gave him a cheery salute. Outside, in Burlington Gardens, a young man in a dented hat and shabby, greasy coat, who had been sitting apparently much at his ease on the rim of a cement planter, rose suddenly to his feet. The shabby young man limped toward Mallory, his shoulders slumped in theatrical despair. He touched the brim of his hat, essayed a pathetic smile, and began to speak to Mallory, all in one breath. "I ask your pardon, sir, but if you would excuse the liberty of being so addressed in the public street by one who is almost reduced to rags, though it has not always been so, and by no fault of my own, but through ill health in my family and many unmerited sufferings, it would be a great obligation, sir, to know the time." The time? Could this man somehow know that Mallory had just purchased a large clock? But the shabby man paid no attention to Mallory's sudden confusion, for he continued on eagerly, in the same insinuating monotone. "Sir, it is not begging that is my intention, for I was brought up by the best of mothers, and begging is not my trade. I should not know how to follow such a trade if such were my shameful wish, for I would sooner die of deprivation. But, sir, I implore you, in the name of charity, to allow me the honor of acting as your porter to carry that case that burdens you for whatever price that your humanity may put upon my services." The shabby man broke off short. He looked wide-eyed over Mallory's shoulder, his mouth assuming a sudden, tight-clamped, pinchy look, like a seamstress biting off a thread. The shabby man took 3 careful steps backward, slowly, keeping Mallory between himself and whatever it was that he saw. And then he turned directly on his flapping, newspaper-stuffed heels and walked swiftly away, without any limp, into the crowded sidewalks of Cork Street. Mallory turned at once and looked behind him. There was a tall, long-shanked, slender man behind him, with a button nose and long side whiskers, in a short Albert coat and plain trousers. Even as Mallory's gaze caught him, the man raised a handkerchief to his face. He coughed in a gentlemanly way, then he dabbed at his eyes a bit. Then he seemed, with a sudden theatrical start, to have recalled something he had forgotten. He turned away and began to wander back toward the Burlington Arcade. He had not once looked straight at Mallory. Mallory himself took a sudden pretended interest in the clasps of his clock case. He set his case down, bent, and looked at the bits of shiny brass with his mind racing and a chill in his spine. The rascal's handkerchief trick had given him away. Mallory recognized him now as the man he had seen by the underground station in Kensington, the coughing gent who would not give up his cab. What's more, thought Mallory, his mind hot with insight, the coughing gent was also the rude man who'd argued with the cabbie about his fare in Piccadilly. He had followed Mallory the whole distance from Kensington. He was trailing him. Mallory seized his clock case in a fierce grip and began to walk quietly down Burlington Gardens. He turned right on Old Bond Street. His nerves were tingling now with a stalker's instinct. He had been a fool to turn and stare at first. Perhaps he had given himself away to his pursuer. Mallory did not turn and look again, but ambled along with his best pretense at leisure. He paused before a jeweler's velvet racks of cameos and bracelets and evening tiaras for her ladyship, and watched the street behind him and the iron-barred shining glass. He saw the coughing gent reappear almost at once. The man hung well back for the moment, careful to keep groups of London shoppers between himself and Mallory. The coughing gent was perhaps 35, with a bit of gray in his side whiskers, and a dark machine-stitched Albert coat that did not look like anything remarkable. His face was that of anyone in London, perhaps a little heavier, a little colder in the eyes, with a grimmer mouth beneath the button nose. Mallory took another turn, left up Bruton Street, his clock case growing more awkward by the step. The shops here lacked conveniently angled glass. He doffed his hat to a pretty woman and pretended to glance back at her ankles. The coughing gent was still with him. Perhaps the coughing gent was a confederate of the tout and his woman, a hired ruffian, a murderer with a derringer in the pocket of that Albert coat, or a vial of vitriol. The hair rose at the base of Mallory's skull, anticipating the sudden impact of the assassin's bullet, the wet, burning splash of corrosion. Mallory began to walk more quickly, the case banging painfully against his leg. Into Berkeley Square, where a small steam crane, chugging gamely between a pair of splintered plane trees, swung a great cast-iron ball into a crumbling Georgian facade. A crowd of spectators was enjoying the sight. He joined them behind the sawhorse barricade, amid the acrid smell of ancient plaster, and sensed a moment's safety. He spied out the coughing gent with a sidelong glance. The fellow looked sinister enough and anxious, having lost Mallory in the crowd for the time being. But he did not seem mad with hatred or nerved to kill. He was glancing about among the legs of the spectators, hunting for Mallory's clock case. Here was a chance to lose the rascal. Mallory made a swift break down the length of the square, taking advantage of the cover of the trees. At the square's far end, he turned down Charles Street, lined right and left with enormous 18th-century houses. Lordly homes, their ornate ironwork hung with modern coats of arms. Behind him, a sumptuous gurney emerged from its carriage house, giving Mallory the chance to stop and turn and study the street. His gambit had failed. The coughing gent was mere yards behind, a bit winded perhaps and red-faced in the sullen heat, but not deceived. He was waiting for Mallory to move again, careful not to look at him. Instead, he gazed with apparent longing at the entrance of a public house named, "I Am the Only Running Footman." It occurred to Mallory to double back and enter the running footman, where he might lose the coughing gent in the crowd. Or perhaps he could leap, at the last moment, onto a departing omnibus, if he could cram his precious case aboard. But Mallory saw little real hope in these expedients. This fellow had the firm advantage of the terrain and all the sneaking tricks of the London criminal. Mallory felt like a lumbering Wyoming bison. He trudged ahead with the heavy clock. His hand ached. He was becoming weary. At the foot of Queen's Way, a drag line and two excavators were wreaking progressive havoc in the ruins of Shepherd Market. A hoarding surrounded the site, the boards cracked and knotholed by eager spectators. Kerchief-headed women and chaw-spitting costermongers, displaced from their customary sites, had set up a last-ditch rag shop just outside the fence. Mallory walked down the line of ill-smelling oysters and limp vegetables. At the end of the hoarding, some accident of planning had left a narrow alleyway. Dusty planks to one side, crumbled brick to the other. Rank weeds sprouted between piss-damp ancient cobbles. Mallory peered in as a bonneted crone arose from a squat, adjusting her skirts. She walked past him without a word. Mallory touched his hat. Heaving the case above his head, he set it gently atop the wall of mossy brick. He shored it up securely with a chunk of decayed mortar and placed his hat beside it. He flattened his back against the wall of planks. The coughing gent appeared. Mallory lunged for the man and punched him in the pit of the belly with all his strength. The man doubled over with a spit and a wheeze, and Mallory clouted him with a short left to the side of the jaw. The man's hat flew off, and he tumbled to his knees. Mallory grabbed the back of the villain's Albert coat and flung him hard against the bricks. The man rebounded, sprawled headlong, and lay gasping, his whiskered face smeared with filth. Mallory snatched him up two-handed by the throat and lapel. "Who are you?"
"Help!"
the man croaked feebly.
"Murder!"
Mallory dragged the man 3 yards down the alley. "Don't play the fool with me, you blackguard. Why are you following me? Who paid you? What's your name?" The man clawed desperately at Mallory's wrist.
"Let me go!"
His coat had flown open. Mallory glimpsed the brown leather of a shoulder holster and reached at once for the weapon in it. It was not a gun. It came out in his hand like a long oiled snake, a truncheon with a braided leather handle and a thick black shaft of India rubber, flattened at the end to a swollen tip like a shoehorn's. It had a spring steel whippiness, as if it were built around a coil of iron. Mallory brandished the ugly device, which felt as if it could easily break bones. The coughing gent cowered before him.
"Answer my questions!"
A bolt of wet lightning blasted the back of Mallory's head. His senses almost left him. He felt himself fall, but caught himself against the filthy cobblestones with arms as numb and heavy as legs of mutton. A second blow fell, but glancingly, across his shoulder. He rolled back and snarled, a thick, barking sound, a cry he had never heard from his own throat. He kicked out at his attacker, somehow caught the man's shin. The man hopped back, cursing. Mallory had lost the truncheon. He lurched up, scrambling, into a giddy crouch. The second man was portly and small. He wore a round derby hat, mashed down almost to his eyebrows. He stood over the outstretched legs of the coughing gent and made a menacing slash at Mallory with a sausage-like leather cosh. Blood coursed down Mallory's neck as a wave of nauseated dizziness struck. He felt he might faint at any moment, and animal instincts told him that if he fell now, he would surely be beaten to death. He turned and fled the alley on wobbling legs. His head seemed to rattle and squeak, as if the sutures of his skull had ruptured. Red mist swirled like oil before his eyes. He tottered a short way down the street and rounded a corner, gasping. He propped himself against a wall, hands braced on his knees. A respectable man and woman passed him and stared in vague distaste. With his nose running, his mouth clogged with nausea, he glared back at them, feebly defiant. He sensed somehow that if the bastards smelled his blood, they would surely tear him down. Time passed. More Londoners strolled past him with looks of indifference, curiosity, faint disapproval, thinking him drunk or sick. Mallory peered through his tears at the building across the street, at the neatly enameled cast-iron sign on its corner. Half Moon Street. Half Moon Street, where Oliphant lived. Mallory felt in his pocket for his field book. It was still there, the familiar touch of its sturdy leather binding like a blessing to him. With trembling fingers, he found Oliphant's card. Once he had reached the address, at the far end of Half Moon Street, he was no longer weaving on his feet. The ugly giddiness in his skull had changed to a painful throbbing. Oliphant lived in a Georgian mansion, divided from modern renters. The ground floor had an elaborate iron railing and a curtained bay window commanding the peaceful vista of Green Park. It was altogether a pleasantly civilized place, entirely unsuitable for a man who was aching, stunned, and dripping blood. Mallory pounded fiercely with the elephant-headed knocker. A manservant opened the door. He looked Mallory up and down. "May I help you?" "Oh, my word!" He turned, raised his voice to a shout. "Mr. Oliphant!" Mallory tottered into the entrance hall, all elegant tile and waxed wainscoting. Oliphant appeared almost at once. In spite of the hour, he was formally dressed, with the smallest of bow ties and a chrysanthemum boutonniere. Oliphant seemed to grasp the situation with a single keen-eyed glance. "Bly, go at once to the kitchen. Fetch brandy from cook, a basin of water, and some clean towels." Bly, the manservant, vanished. Oliphant stepped to the open door, glanced warily up and down the street, then shut and locked the door securely. Taking Mallory's arm, he guided him into the parlor, where Mallory lowered himself wearily on a piano bench. "So you've been attacked," Oliphant said. "Set upon from behind. A cowardly ambush by the look of it." "How bad is it? I can't see." "A blow from a blunt instrument. The skin is broken and you have a considerable bruise. It's bled rather freely, but is clotting now." "Is it serious?" "I've seen worse." Oliphant's tone was ironically cheerful. "But it's quite spoilt that handsome jacket of yours, I'm afraid." "They stalked me all through Piccadilly," Mallory said. "I didn't see the second one until it was too late." He sat up suddenly. "Damn! My clock!" "A clock, a wedding gift. I left it in an alleyway by Shepherd Market. Those rascals will have stolen it." Bly reappeared with towels and basin. He was shorter and older than his master, clean-shaven and thick-necked, with bulging brown eyes. His hairy wrists were thick as a collier's. He and Oliphant shared an air of easy respect, as though the man were a trusted family retainer. Oliphant dabbed a towel in the basin and stepped behind Mallory. "Be quite still, please." "My clock," Mallory repeated. Oliphant sighed. "Bly, do you think you could see to this gentleman's mislaid property? There's a degree of danger, of course." "Yes, sir," Bly said solidly. "And the guests, sir?" Oliphant seemed to think it over, dabbing wetly at the back of Mallory's skull. "Why don't you take the guests with you, Bly? I'm sure they'd enjoy the outing. Take them out the back way. Try not to create too much of a public spectacle." "What shall I tell them, sir?" "Tell them the truth, of course. Tell them that a friend of the household has been assaulted by foreign agents, but tell them they mustn't kill anyone. And if they don't find this clock of Dr. Mallory's, they mustn't think it a reflection on their abilities. Make a joke of it if you must, but don't allow them to feel they've lost prestige." "I understand, sir," Bly said, and left. "Sorry to impose," Mallory muttered. "Nonsense. It's what we're here for." Oliphant offered Mallory two fingers of very good brandy in a crystal tumbler. With the brandy, the dry-throated shock oozed out of Mallory, leaving him in pain, but far less numb and harried. "You were right, and I was wrong," he declared. "They were stalking me like an animal. They were no common ruffian. They meant me harm, I'm sure of it." "Texian?" "Londoners. A tall cove with side whiskers, and a little fat one in a derby hat." "Hirelings." Oliphant dabbled a towel in the basin. "You could do with a stitch or two, I think. Shall I summon a doctor? Or do you trust me to do it? I've done a bit of surgeon's work in rough country. So have I, Mallory said. Pray go ahead if you think it necessary. He had another gulp of Oliphant's brandy while the man fetched needle and thread. Then Mallory doffed his coat, clenched his jaw, and stared at the blue floral wallpaper while Oliphant deftly pierced the torn skin and sutured it. Not a bad job, Oliphant said, pleased. Stay out of unwholesome effluvia, and you'll likely escape without a fever. All London's an effluvium today, this beastly weather. I don't trust doctors, do you? They don't know what they're talking about. Unlike diplomats or catastrophists. Oliphant's charming smile made it impossible for Mallory to take offense. Mallory picked his jacket from the piano bench. Bloodstains matted its collar. Now what? Shall I go to the police? That's your privilege, of course, Oliphant said, though I would trust to your patriotic discretion to leave certain matters unmentioned. Certain matters such as Lady Ada Byron? Oliphant frowned. To speculate wildly about the Prime Minister's daughter would, I'm afraid, be a very severe indiscretion. I see. And what about my gun running for the Royal Society's Commission on Free Trade, then? I make the unfounded assumption that the Commission's scandals differ from Lady Ada's. Well, said Oliphant, gratifying as it would be to me personally to see your Commission's blunders publicly exposed, I fear that entire business must remain sub rosa, in the interests of the British nation. I see. What exactly is left to me to say to the police, then? Oliphant smiled thinly. That you were struck on the head by an unnamed ruffian for unknown reasons. This is ridiculous, Mallory snapped. Aren't you government mandarins good for anything? This isn't some game of parlor charades, you know. I identified that female fiend who helped hold Lady Ada captive. Her name is Florence Bartlett, Oliphant said, and pray keep your voice down. How did you... Mallory stopped. Your friend Mr. Wakefield, is it? I suppose he watched all my business at the Statistics Bureau and dashed off at once to tell you everything. It's Wakefield's business, however tedious, to watch the business of his own blessed engines, Oliphant said calmly. I was expecting you to tell me, actually, now that you know that you were enticed by an authentic femme fatale. But you don't seem eager to share your information, sir. Mallory grunted. This is no matter for the common police, Oliphant said. I told you earlier that you should have special protection. Now I'm afraid I must insist. Bloody hell, Mallory muttered. I've the very man for this assignment. Inspector Ebenezer Fraser of the Bow Street Special Branch. The very special branch. So you mustn't say that too loudly. But you'll find Inspector Fraser, or Mr. Fraser, as he prefers to be called in public, to be most capable, most understanding, and very discreet. I know you'll be safe in Fraser's hands, and I cannot tell you what a relief that will be to me. A door shut in the back of the house. There were footsteps, scrapings and clinkings, strange voices. Then Bligh reappeared. My clock, Mallory cried. Thank heaven! We found it atop a wall, with a bit of brick propping it up, rather hidden away, Bligh said, setting down the case. Scarcely a scratch on it. I surmise the ruffians cached it there for later looting, sir. Oliphant nodded with an arched eyebrow at Mallory. Fine work, Bligh. And then there was this, sir. Bligh produced a trampled topper. It's that rascal's, Mallory declared. The coughing gent's crushed hat had been liberally soaked in a puddle of stale piss, though no one saw fit to mention this unspeakable fact. Sorry to miss your own hat, sir, Bligh said, likely stolen by some street Arab. Oliphant, with the faintest wince of involuntary distaste, examined the ruined topper, turning it over and inverting the lining. No maker's mark. Mallory glanced at it. Engine made, from Moses and Son, I should say, about 2 years old. Well, Oliphant blinked, I presume that evidence rules out any foreigner. A London veteran, surely. A user of cheap Macassar oil, but a man of enough cranial capacity to have a certain cunning. Put it in the rubbish, Bly. Yes, sir. Bly left. Mallory patted the clock case with deep satisfaction. Your man Bly has done me a great service. Do you think he would object to a gratuity? Most decidedly, Oliphant said. Mallory felt the gaff. He gritted his teeth. What about these guests of yours? Might I be permitted to thank them? Oliphant smiled with abandon. Why not? He led Mallory into the dining room. The mahogany legs had been detached from Oliphant's dining table, and the great polished surface now sat on its corners of carven gingerbread, mere inches above the floor. Five Asian men sat about it, in cross-legged alien dignity. Five sober men in their stocking feet, wearing tailored evening suits from Savile Row. All the men sported tall silk toppers, tugged low over their clippered heads. Their hair was very short and very dark. And a woman was with them as well, kneeling at the table's foot. She had a look of mask-like composure and a silky black wealth of hair. She was wrapped in some voluminous native garb, bright with swallows and maple leaves. Dr. Edward Mallory, Sano Goshokai Shimasu, Oliphant said. The men rose with peculiar grace, rocking back a bit, sliding one foot beneath them, and coming up quite suddenly to a supple-legged stance, as if they were ballet dancers. These gentlemen are in the service of His Imperial Majesty, the Mikado of Japan, Oliphant said. This is Mr. Matsuki Koan, Mr. Mori Arinori, Mr. Fusukawa Yukichi, Mr. Kanaye Nagasawa, Mr. Hisanobu Sameshima. The men bowed from the hips, each in turn. Oliphant had made no attempt to introduce the woman. She sat with expressionless rigidity, as if secretly resenting the gaze of an Englishman. Mallory thought it wise not to mention the matter, or pay her much attention. Instead, he turned to Oliphant. Japanese, are they? You speak the lingo, do you? A diplomatic smattering. Would you please thank them for so gallantly fetching my clock, then? We understand you, Dr. Mallory, said one of the Japanese. Mallory had immediately forgotten their impossible names, but thought that this one might be called Yukichi. It is honor to us to assist British friend of Mr. Lawrence Oliphant, to whom our sovereign has expressed obligation. Mr. Yukichi bowed again. Mallory was utterly at sea. Thank you for that courteous speech, sir. You're a very well-spoken gentleman, I must say. I'm not a diplomat myself, but I do thank you sincerely. Very kind of all of you. The Japanese conferred among themselves. We hope you are not badly hurt by barbaric assault on your British person by foreigners, said Mr. Yukichi. No, Mallory said. We did not see your enemy, nor any rude or violent person. Mr. Yukichi's tone was mild, but his glinting eyes left Mallory little doubt as to what Yukichi and his friends would have done had they met such a ruffian. As a group, the five Japanese had a refined, scholarly air. Two were wearing rimless spectacles, and one had a ribboned monocle and dandyish yellow gloves. But they were all young and deft and sturdy, and their toppers were perched on their heads like Viking helmets. Oliphant's long legs buckled suddenly beneath him, and he sat at the head of the table with a smile. Mallory sat, too, his kneecaps popping loudly. The Japanese followed Oliphant's lead, quickly tucking themselves into the same positions of arid dignity. The woman had not moved so much as an inch. Under the circumstances, Oliphant mused, dreadful hot day, a tiring foray after enemies of the realm, a small libation is in order. He lifted a brass bell from the table and rang it. So, let's get friendly, eh? Nani o nami ni narimasu ka? The Japanese conferred, their eyes widening, with happy nods and sharp grunts of approval. Uisuki. Whiskey, an excellent choice, said Oliphant. Bligh arrived momentarily with a trolley of liquor bottles.
We're low on ice, sir.
What's that, Bligh?
Iceman wouldn't sell Cook but a bit. Price has trebled since last week.
Well, ice wouldn't fit into the doll's bottle anyway, said Oliphant lightly, just as if that remark made sense. Now, Dr. Mallory, pay close heed. Mr. Matsuki Kowan, who happens to hail from the very advanced province of Satsuma, was just demonstrating to us one of the marvels of Japanese craft. Who was the craftsman again, Mr. Matsuki?
She is made by sons of Hosokawa family, said Mr. Matsuki, bowing in place. Our lord, Satsuma Daimyo, is patron.
I believe Mr. Matsuki will do the honors, Bligh, said Oliphant. Bligh handed Mr. Matsuki a whiskey bottle. Mr. Matsuki began to decant it into an elegant ceramic jug at the right hand of the Japanese woman. She made no response. Mallory began to wonder if she were ill or paralyzed. Then Mr. Matsuki fitted the little jug into her right hand with a sharp wooden click. He rose and fetched a gilded crank handle. He stuck the device into the small of her back and began to twist it, his face expressionless. A high-pitched coiling sound emerged from the woman's innards.
She's a dummy, Mallory blurted.
More a marionette, actually, Oliphant said. The proper term is automaton, I believe. Mallory drew a breath.
I see. Like one of those Jacot Draws toys, or Vaucanson's famous duck, eh?
He laughed. It was now obvious at a glance that the mask-like face, half shrouded by the elegant black hair, was in fact carved and painted wood.
That blow must have addled my brains. Heaven, what a marvel!
Every hair in her wig put in by hand, Oliphant said. She's a royal gift for Her Britannic Majesty, though I imagine the Prince Consort, and especially young Alfred, might take quite a fancy to her as well. The automaton began pouring drinks. There was a hinge within her robed elbow, and a second in her wrist. She poured whiskey with a gentle slither of cables and a muted wooden clicking.
She moves much like an engine-guided Maudsley lathe, Mallory noted. Is that where they got the plans?
No, she's entirely native, said Oliphant. Mr. Matsuki was passing little ceramic cups of whiskey down the table. Not a bit of metal in her. All bamboo and braided horsehair and whalebone springs. The Japanese have known how to make such dolls for many years. Karakuri, they call them. Mallory sipped his whiskey. Scotch, single malt. He was already a bit squiffed from Oliphant's brandy. Now the sight of the doll made him feel as if he had blundered into a Christmas pantomime.
Does she walk, he asked? Play the flute, perhaps? Or any of that business?
No, she simply pours, said Oliphant. With either hand, though. Mallory felt the eyes of the Japanese fixed on him. It was clear that the doll was no particular marvel to them. They wanted to know what he, a Briton, thought of her. They wanted to know if he was impressed.
She is very impressive, he blurted. Especially so given the primitive nature of Asia.
Japan is the Britain of Asia, Oliphant said.
We know she is not much, said Mr. Yukichi, his eyes glinting.
No, she's a marvel, truly, Mallory insisted. Why, you could charge admission.
We know she is not much compared to your great British machines. It is as Mr. Oliphant says. We are your younger brothers in this world.
We will learn, said another Japanese, speaking for the first time. He was likely the one called Arinori.
We have great obligation to Britain. Britain opened our ports with the Iron Fleet. We have awaked and learnt great lessons you have taught us. We have destroyed our shogun and his backward Bakufu. Mikado will lead us now in great new progress age. We will be allies with you, said Mr. Yukichi nobly. The Britain of Asia will bring civilization and enlightenment to all Asian peoples.
That's very laudable of you, said Mallory. It's a bit of a hard slog, though, civilization, building an empire. Takes several centuries, you know.
We learn everything from you now, said Mr. Arinori. His face was flushed. The whiskey and heat seemed to have kindled a fire in him. We build great schools and navies, like you. In Choshu, we have an engine. We will buy more engines. We will build our own engine.
Mallory chuckled. The queer little foreigners seemed so young, so idealistic, intelligent, and above all sincere. He felt quite sorry for them. Well, it's a fine dream, young sir, and does you credit, but it's no simple matter. You see, we in Britain have devoted great effort to those engines. You might well call that the central aim of our nation. Our savants have worked on enginery for decades now. For you, in a few short years, to achieve what we have done, we will make whatever sacrifice is necessary, said Mr. Yukichi calmly.
There are other ways to improve the homeland of your race, Mallory said, but what you propose is simply impossible. We will make whatever sacrifice is necessary.
Mallory glanced at Oliphant, who sat with a fixed smile, watching the wind-up girl filling china cups. Perhaps the faint chill in the air was only Mallory's imagination, yet he felt he had blundered somehow. There was silence, broken only by the ticking automaton. Mallory got to his feet, his head pounding.
I appreciate your kindness, Mr. Oliphant, and the help of your guests, of course. But I can't stay, you know. Very pleasant here, but press of business.
You're quite sure? Oliphant asked cordially.
Yes.
Oliphant lifted his voice.
Bly, send Cook's boy to fetch Dr. Mallory a cab.
Mallory's night passed in sodden fatigue. He woke from a confused dream in which he argued catastrophism with the coughing gent, to hear repeated knocking at his door.
A moment.
He flung his bare legs from bed, yawned groggily, and tenderly cradled the back of his skull. His bruise had bled a bit in the night, leaving a pinkish stain on the pillow slip, but the swelling was down and he did not feel feverish. Likely it was the therapeutic work of Oliphant's excellent liquor. Pulling a nightshirt over his perspiring nudity, he wrapped himself in a dressing gown and opened the door. The palace concierge, an Irishman named Kelly, stood in the hall with a pair of glum-faced chars. They were equipped with mops, galvanized buckets, black rubber funnels, and a push cart crowded with stoppered Jeroboams.
What is the time, Kelly?
9 o'clock, sir.
Kelly entered, sucking his yellow teeth. The women trundled in after him with their cart. Gaudy paper labels declared each ceramic bottle to contain Condi's patent oxygenating deodorizer, 1 imperial gallon.
What's all this?
Manganate of soda, sir, to see to the palace plumbing. We plan to flush every closet, clear the palace pipes out, straight down to the main drains.
Mallory adjusted his robe. It embarrassed him to appear with his feet and ankles bared before the charwomen.
Kelly, it won't do a dashed bit of good if you flush your pipes straight to hell. It is metropolitan London in a wretched hot summer. Even the Thames stinks.
Have to do something, sir. Kelly said. Our guests are complaining, most vigorously. I can't say as I blame them, sir.
The women funneled a jug of the decoction, which was bright purple, into the bowl of Mallory's water closet. The deodorizer emitted a piercing ammoniacal reek, far more vile in its own way than the lingering taint in his room. They scrubbed wearily at the porcelain, sneezing, until Kelly pulled the cistern chain with a magisterial gesture. Then they left, and Mallory dressed. He checked his notebook. The afternoon's schedule was crowded, but the morning had only a single appointment. Mallory had already learned that Disraeli's tardiness made it best to allot him half the day. With luck, he might find time to take his jacket in for French cleaning, or have a barber trim the clots from his hair. When he went down to the dining room, two other late breakfasters were chatting over tea. One was a cabinet man named Belshaw, the other a museum underling whose name might be Sydenham. Mallory couldn't quite recall. Belshaw looked up as Mallory entered the room. Mallory nodded civilly. Belshaw gazed back at him with barely concealed astonishment. Mallory walked past the two men, taking his customary seat beneath the gilt gas chandelier. Belshaw and Sydenham began to talk in low, urgent tones. Mallory was nonplussed. He had never been formally introduced to Belshaw, but could the man possibly resent a simple nod? Now Sydenham, his pudgy face gone pale, was casting sidelong glances at Mallory. Mallory wondered if his fly was open. It was not. But the men's eyes goggled with apparently genuine alarm. Had his wound opened? Was his hair dripping blood down his neck? It did not seem so. Mallory gave his breakfast order to a waiter. The servant's face, too, was wooden, as if the choice of kippers and eggs were a grave indiscretion. Mallory, growing steadily more confused, had a mind to confront Belshaw on the matter, and began to rehearse a little speech. But Belshaw and Sydenham rose suddenly, quitting their tea, and left the dining room. Mallory ate his breakfast with grim deliberation, determined not to let the incident upset him. He went to the front desk to fetch his basket of mail. The usual desk clock was not on duty. "Taken down with a catarrh of the lungs," his replacement said. Mallory retired with his basket to his customary seat in the library. There were five of his palace colleagues present, gathered in a corner of the room, where they were anxiously conversing. As Mallory glanced up, he thought he caught them staring at him. But this was nonsense. Mallory sorted through his correspondence with desultory interest, his head aching slightly and his mind already drifting. There was a tedious burden of necessary professional correspondence, and the usual tiresome freight of admiring missives and begging letters. Perhaps the engagement of a personal secretary might in fact be unavoidable. Struck by an odd inspiration, Mallory wondered if young Mr. Tobias of the Central Statistics Bureau might not be just the man for this post. Perhaps an offer of alternate employment would increase the fellow's daring in the office, for there was much at the Bureau that Mallory longed to peruse. The file on Lady Ada, for instance, should such a fabulous item exist, or the slippery Mr. Oliphant, with his ready smiles and vague assurances, or Lord Charles Lyell, the medal-heavy savant chief of the uniformitarian faction. These three worthies were likely well above his reach, Mallory thought. But he might well ferret out a bit of data on Peter Folk, a sinister rascal whose web of underhanded intrigue was ever more manifest. He would have it all out somehow. Mallory felt quite sure of that as he shuffled through his mail basket. The whole occulted business would slowly emerge, like bones chipped from their bed of shale. He had glimpsed the closeted skeletons of the Rad Elite. Now, given time and a chance to work, he would wrench the mystery whole from its stony matrix. His attention was caught by a most unusual packet. It was of non-standard dimensions, rather blocky and square, and it bore a colorful set of French express stamps. The ivory-yellow envelope, astonishingly slick and stiff, was of a most unusual waterproof substance, something like isinglass. Mallory took out his Sheffield knife, selected the smallest of several blades, and worried the thing open. The interior bore a single French engine card of the Napoleon gauge. Mallory, with growing alarm, shook the card free onto the tabletop. He did this with some difficulty, for the slick interior of the envelope was clearly damp. It was dewy with a chemical moisture, giving off an increasingly virulent stench as it was exposed to air. The card, a blank without holes, for a neat block of tiny black print, all in capitals. "To Dr. Edward Mallory, Palace of Paleontology, London. You are in guilty possession of a property stolen at Epsom. You will return this property to us, whole and complete, following the orders given you in the personal notices columns of the London Daily Express. Until we receive this property, you will suffer a variety of deliberate punishments, culminating, if necessary, in your entire and utter destruction. Edward Mallory, we know your number, your identity, your history, and your ambitions. We are fully cognizant of your every weakness. Resistance is useless. Swift and complete submission is your only hope. Captain Swing." Mallory sat in astonishment, memory rushing vividly upon him. Wyoming again, a morning when he'd risen from his camp bed to find a rattlesnake dozing in his body heat. He had felt the serpent squirming below his back in the depths of his sleep, but had drowsily ignored it. Here now was the sudden, scaly proof. He snatched the card up, examining it minutely. Camphorated cellulose, damp with something pungent, and the tiny black letters were beginning to fade. The flexible card had grown hot in his fingers. He dropped it at once, choking back a yelp of surprise. The card lay warping on the tabletop, then began flaking into layers thinner than the finest onion skin, while browning nastily at the edges. A feather of yellowish smoke began to rise, and Mallory realized that the thing was about to burst into flame. He snatched hastily within the basket, came up with the latest thick gray issue of the Quarterly Journal Geological Society, and swiftly swatted the card. After two sharp blows, it came apart into a thready, curling mess, half mixed with the blistered finish of the tabletop. Mallory slit open a begging letter, tossed the contents out unread, and swept the ash into the envelope with the sharp-edged spine of the Geological Journal. The table did not seem too badly damaged. "Dr. Mallory?" Mallory looked up, with a guilt-stricken start, into the face of a stranger. The man, a tall and clean-shaven Londoner, very plainly dressed, with a gaunt, unsmiling look, stood across the library table from Mallory, papers and a notebook in one hand. "A very poor specimen," Mallory said, in a sudden ecstasy of impromptu deception. "Pickled in camphor. A dreadful technique." He folded the envelope and slid it in his pocket. The stranger silently offered a carte de visite. Ebenezer Fraser's card bore his name, a telegram number, and a small embossed seal of state. Nothing else. The other side offered a stippled portrait with the look of stone-faced gravity that seemed the man's natural expression. Mallory rose to offer his hand, then realized that his fingers were tainted with acid. He bowed instead, sat at once, and wiped his hand furtively on the back of his trouser leg. The skin of thumb and forefinger felt desiccated, as if dipped in formaldehyde. "I hope I find you well, sir," Fraser murmured, seating himself across the table. "Recovered from yesterday's attack?" Mallory glanced down the length of the library. The other patrons were still clumped together at the far side of the room, and seemed very curious indeed about his antics and Fraser's sudden appearance. "A trifle," Mallory hedged. "Might happen to anyone in London." Fraser lifted one dark eyebrow by a fraction. "Sorry, my mishap should cause you to take trouble, Mr. Fraser." "No trouble, sir." Fraser opened a leather-bound notebook and produced a reservoir pen from within his plain Quakerish jacket. "Some questions?" "Truth to tell, I'm rather pressed for time at the moment." Fraser silenced him with an impassive look. "Been here 3 hours, sir, awaiting your convenience." Mallory began a fumbling apology. Fraser ignored him. "I witnessed something quite curious outside at 6 o'clock this morning, sir. A young newsboy crying to the world that Leviathan Mallory was arrested for murder." "Me? Edward Mallory?" Fraser nodded. "I don't understand. Why should any newsboy cry any such damnable lie?" "Sold a deal of his papers," Fraser said dryly. "Bought one myself." "What on earth did this paper have to say about me?" "Not a word of news about any Mallory," Fraser said. "You may see for yourself." He dropped a folded newspaper on the tabletop, a London Daily Express. Mallory set the newspaper carefully atop his basket. "Some wicked prank," he suggested, his throat dry. "The street Arabs here are nerved for anything." "When I stepped out again, the little rascal had hooked it," Fraser said. "But a deal of your colleagues heard that newsboy crying his tale. Been the talk of the place all morning." "I see," Mallory said. "That accounts for a certain..." "Well..." He cleared his throat. Fraser watched him impassively. "You'd best see this now, sir." He took a folded document from his notebook, opened it, and slid it across the polished mahogany. An engine printed daguerreotype. A dead man, full length on a slab, a bit of linen tucked about his loins. The picture had been taken in a morgue. The corpse had been knifed open from belly to sternum with a single tremendous ripping thrust. The skin of chest and legs and bulging belly was marble pale, in eerie contrast to the deeply sunburnt hands, the florid face. It was Francis Rudwick. There was a caption at the bottom of the picture. "A scientific autopsy," it read. "The batrachian subject is pithed and opened in a catastrophic dissection, first in a series." "God in heaven," Mallory said. "Official police morgue record," Fraser said. "Seems it fell into the hands of a mischief maker." Mallory stared at it in horror-struck amazement. "What can it mean?" Fraser readied his pen. "What is batrachian, sir?" "From the Greek," Mallory blurted. "Batrachos, amphibian, frogs and toads mostly." He struggled for words. "Once, years ago, in a debate, I said that his theories, Rudwick's geological theories, you know. I heard the story this morning, sir. It seems well known among your colleagues." Fraser flipped pages in his notebook. "You said to Mr. Rudwick, the course of evolution does not conform to the batrachian sluggishness of your intellect." He paused. "Fellow did look a bit froggy, didn't he, sir?" "It was in public debate at Cambridge," Mallory said slowly. "Our blood was up." "Rudwick claimed you were mad as a hatter," Fraser mused. "Seems you took that remark very ill." Mallory flushed. "He had no right to say that, with his gentry airs. You were enemies." "Yes, but..." Mallory wiped his forehead. "You can't believe I had anything to do with this." "Not by your own intention, I am sure," Fraser said. "But I believe you're a Sussex man, sir. Town called Lewis." "Yes?" "Seems that some scores of these pictures have been mailed from the Lewis postal office." Mallory was stunned. "Scores of them?" "Mailed far and wide to your Royal Society colleagues, sir, anonymously." "Christ in heaven," Mallory said. "They mean to destroy me." Fraser said nothing. Mallory stared at the morgue picture. Suddenly the simple human pity of the sight struck him with terrible force. "Poor damned Rudwick. Look what they've done to him." Fraser watched him politely. "He was one of us," Mallory blurted, stung into angry sincerity. "He was no theorist, but a damned fine bone digger. My God, think of his poor family." Fraser made a note. "Family. Must inquire into that. Very likely they've been told you murdered him." "But I was in Wyoming when Rudwick was killed. Everyone knows that." "A wealthy man might hire the business done." "I'm not a wealthy man." Fraser said nothing. "I wasn't," Mallory said. "Not then." Fraser leafed deliberately through his notebook. "I won the money gambling." Fraser showed mild interest. "My colleagues have noticed how I spend it," Mallory concluded with a chill sensation, "and wondered whence the money came. And they talk about me behind my back, eh?"
"Envy does set tongues wagging, sir."
Mallory felt a sudden giddy dread. Menace filled the air like a cloud of wasps. After a moment, in Fraser's tactful silence, Mallory rallied himself. He shook his head slowly, set his jaw. He would not be mazed or driven. There was work to do. There was evidence at hand. Mallory bent forward with a scowl and studied the picture fiercely. "First of a series, this says. This is a threat, Mr. Fraser. It implies similar murders to follow. A catastrophic dissection. This refers to our scientific quarrel, as if he'd died because of that.
Savants take their quarrels very seriously, Fraser said.
Can you mean to say that my colleagues believe I sent this? That I hire assassins like a Machiavel? That I am a dangerous maniac who boasts of murdering his rivals?
Fraser said nothing.
My God, Mallory said. What am I to do?
My superiors have set this case within my purview, Fraser said formally. I must ask you to trust in my discretion, Dr. Mallory.
But what am I to do about the damage to my reputation? Am I to go to every man in this building and beg his pardon and tell him I am not some hellish ghoul?
Government will not allow a prominent savant to be harassed in this manner, Fraser assured him quietly. Tomorrow, in Bow Street, the Commissioner of Police will issue a statement to the Royal Society, declaring you a victim of malicious slander and innocent of all suspicion in the Rudwick affair.
Mallory rubbed his beard. Will that help, you think?
If necessary, we will issue a public statement to the daily newspapers as well.
But might not such publicity arouse more suspicion against me?
Fraser shifted a bit in his library chair. Dr. Mallory, my bureau exists to destroy conspiracies. We are not without experience. We are not without our resources. We will not be trumped by some shabby clique of dark lanternists. We mean to have the lot of these plotters, branch and root, and we will do it sooner, sir, if you are frank with me, and tell me all you know.
Mallory sat back in his chair. It is in my nature to be frank, Mr. Fraser, but it is a dark and scandalous story. You need not fear for my sensibilities.
Mallory looked about at the mahogany shelves, the bound journals, the leather-bound texts and outsized atlases. Suspicion hung in the air like a burning taint. After yesterday's street assault, the palace had seemed a welcome fortress to him, but now it felt like a badger's bolt hole.
This ain't the place to tell it, Mallory muttered.
No, sir, Fraser agreed. But you should go about your scientific business, same as always. Put a bold face on matters, and likely your enemies will think their stratagems failed. The advice seemed sound to Mallory. At the least, it was action. He rose at once to his feet.
Go about my daily business, eh? Yes, I should think so. Quite proper.
Fraser rose as well.
I will accompany you, sir, with your permission. I trust we will put a sharp end to your troubles.
You might not think so if you knew the whole damned business, Mallory grumbled.
Mr. Oliphant has informed me on the matter.
I doubt it, Mallory grunted. He has closed his eyes to the worst of it.
I'm no bloody politician, Fraser remarked in his same mild tone.
Shall we be on our way, sir?
Outside the palace, the London sky was a canopy of yellow haze. It hung above the city in gloomy grandeur, like some storm-fleshed, jellied man-o'-war. Its tentacles, the uprising filth of the city's smokestacks, twisted and fluted like candle smoke in utter stillness, to splash against a lidded ceiling of glowering cloud. The invisible sun cast a drowned and watery light.
Mallory studied the street around him, a London summer morning made strange by the eerie richness of the sooty amber light.
Mr. Fraser, you're a London man, born and bred, I take it?
Yes, sir.
Have you ever seen weather like this?
Fraser considered, squinting at the sky.
Not since I were a lad, sir, when the coal fogs were bad. But the rads built taller stacks. Nowadays it blows off into the counties.
He paused. Mostly.
Mallory considered the flat clouds, fascinated. He wished he'd spent more time on the doctrines of pneumodynamics. This pot-lid of static cloud displayed an unhealthy lack of natural turbulence, as though the dynamical systematics of the atmosphere had stagnated somehow. The stinking underground, the droughty, sewage-thickened Thames, and now this. Doesn't seem as hot as yesterday, he muttered. The gloom, sir. The streets were such a crush as only London could produce. The omnibuses and cabriolets were all taken, every intersection jammed with rattle-traps and dog-carts, with cursing drivers and panting black-nostled horses. Steam gurneys chugged sluggishly by, many towing rubber-tired freight cars loaded with provisions. It seemed the gentry's summer exodus from London was becoming a rout. Mallory could see the sense in it. It was a long walk to Fleet Street and his appointment with Disraeli. It seemed best to try the train and endure the stink. But the British Brotherhood of Sappers and Miners stood on strike at the entrance to Gloucester Road Station. They had set up pickets and banners across the walk and were heaping sandbags like an army of occupation. A large crowd looked on, keeping good order. They did not seem annoyed by the strikers' boldness, but seemed curious or cowed. Perhaps they were glad to see the underground shut. More likely, they were simply afraid of the sand hogs. The helmeted strikers had boiled up from their underground workings like so many muscular kobolds. I don't like the look of this, Mr. Fraser.
No, sir.
Let's have a word with these fellows. Mallory crossed the street. He accosted a squat, veiny-nosed sandhog, who was bawling at the crowd and forcing leaflets upon them. What's the trouble here, Brother Sapper? The sandhog looked Mallory up and down, and grinned around an ivory toothpick. There was a large gold-plated hoop in his ear, or perhaps real gold, as the Brotherhood was a wealthy union, owning many ingenious patents. I'll give ye the long and short of it, mister, since ye ask so civil-like. 'Tis the goddamn bloody hare-brained pneumatic trains. We told Lord Babbage in petition that the bleeding tunnels never would air proper, but some spunking bastard savant gave us some fookin' nonsense lecture, and now the bastard things have gone sour as rotten piss. That's a serious matter, sir. You're fookin' right it is, cove. Do you know the name of the consulting savant? The sandhog talked the question over with a pair of his helmeted friends. Lordship name of Jefferies. I know Jefferies, Mallory said, surprised. He claimed that Rudwick's pterodactyl couldn't fly, claimed he'd proven it a torpid gliding reptile that couldn't flap its own wings. The rascal's an incompetent. He should be censured for fraud. Savant yourself, are ye, mister? Not one of his sort, Mallory said. What about your pal, the fookin' copper, here? The sandhog tugged agitatedly at the ring in his ear. Wouldn't be taking all this down in your bleeding notebooks, would ye? Not at all, Mallory said with dignity. Simply wanted to know the full truth of the matter. You want to know the bloody truth, your savantship. You'll crawl down there and scrape yourself a bucketful of that moldy shite off the bricks. Sewermen of 20 years standing are tossing their guts from the stink. The sandhog moved to confront a woman in banded crinoline. You can't go down there, darling. Ain't a single train rolling in London. Mallory moved on. We haven't heard the last of this, he muttered aloud, vaguely in Fraser's direction. When a savant takes on industrial consultation, he needs to be sure of his facts. It's the weather, Fraser said. Not at all. It's a matter of savantry ethics. I got such a call myself. Fellow in Yorkshire wants to build a glass conservatory on the pattern of Brontosaurus spine and ribs. The vault work is fine and efficient, I told him, but the glass seals will surely leak. So, no job and no consulting fee, but my reputation as a scholar is upheld. Mallory snorted on the oily air, cleared his throat, and spat into the gutter. I can't believe that damned fool Jefferies would give Lord Babbage such poor advice. Never saw any savant talk straight to a sandhog. Then you don't know Ned Mallory. I honor any honest man who truly knows his business. Fraser considered this. He seemed a bit dubious, if one could judge by his leaden expression. Dangerous working-class rioters, your sandhogs. A fine radical union. They stood stoutly by the party in the early days, and still do. killed a deal of police in the time of troubles.
But those were Wellington's police, Mallory said. Fraser nodded somberly.
There seemed little help for it but to walk all the way to Disraeli's. Fraser, whose long-legged, loping stride matched Mallory's with ease, was nothing loath. Retracing their steps, they entered Hyde Park, Mallory hoping for a breath of fresher air. But here the summer foliage seemed half-wilted in the oily stillness, and the greenish light beneath the boughs was extraordinary in its glum malignity. The sky had become a bowl of smoke, roiling and thickening. The untoward sight seemed to panic the London starlings, for a great flock of the little birds had risen over the park. Mallory watched in admiration as he walked. Flocking activity was a very elegant lesson in dynamical physics. Quite extraordinary how the systematic interaction of so many little birds could form vast, elegant shapes in the air. A trapezoid, then a lopped-off pyramid, becoming a flattened crescent, then bowing up in the center like the movement of a tidal surge. There was likely a good paper in the phenomenon. Mallory stumbled on a tree root. Fraser caught his arm.
Sir.
Yes, Mr. Fraser.
Keep an eye peeled, if you would. We might perhaps be followed.
Mallory glanced about him. It was not much use. The park was crowded, and he could see no sign of the coughing gent or his derbied henchman. On Rotten Row, a small detachment of Amazon cavalry, pretty horse breakers they were called in the papers, this being a euphemism for well-to-do courtesans, had gathered about one of their number, thrown from her side saddle by her chestnut gelding. Mallory and Fraser, as they came closer, saw that the beast had collapsed and lay frothily panting in the damp grass by the side of the trail. The rider was muddied but unhurt. She was cursing London and the filthy air, and the women who had urged her to gallop, and the man who had bought her the horse. Fraser politely ignored the unseemly spectacle.
Sir, in my line of work we learn to cultivate the open air. There are no doors ajar or keyholes about us at the moment. Will you inform me of your troubles, in your own plain words, as you yourself have witnessed the event?
Mallory tramped on silently for some moments, juggling the matter in his mind. He was tempted to trust Fraser. Of all those men in authority whose aid he might have sought in his troubles, this sturdy policeman alone seemed primed to boldly grapple problems at their root. Yet there was much hazard in that trust, and the risk was not to himself alone. Mr. Fraser, the reputation of a very great lady is involved in this affair. Before I speak, I must have your word as a gentleman that you will not damage the lady's interests. Fraser walked on with a meditative air, hands clasped behind his back.
Ada Byron, he asked at length.
Why, yes. Oliphant told you the truth, did he? Fraser slowly shook his head.
Mr. Oliphant is very discreet. But we of Bow Street are often called upon to put the muzzle on the Byron's family difficulties. One might almost say that we specialize in the effort.
But you seemed to know almost at once, Mr. Fraser. How could that be?
Sad experience, sir. I know those words of yours. I know that worshipful tone. The interests of a very great lady. Fraser gazed about the gloomy park, taking in the curved benches of teak and iron, crowded with open-collared men, flush-faced women fanning themselves, wilted hordes of city children gone red-eyed and peevish in the stinking heat. Your duchesses, your countesses, they all had their fancy mansions burnt down in the time of troubles. Your rad ladyships may put on airs, but no one calls them great ladies in quite that old-fashioned way, unless referring to the Queen herself, or our so-called Queen of Engines. He stepped carefully over the small feathered corpse of a starling, lying quite dead in the graveled path, with its wings spread and its small wrinkled claws in the air. A few yards on, the two slowed to pick their way through a score of them.
Perhaps you'd best begin at the beginning, sir. Start with the late Mr. Rudwick and that business.
Very well.
Mallory wiped sweat from his face. His kerchief came away dotted with specks of soot.
I am a doctor of paleontology. It follows that I'm a good party man. My family is somewhat humble, but thanks to the Rads, I took a doctorate with honors. I loyally support my government.
Go on, Fraser said. I had 2 years in South America, bone digging with Lord Loudon, but I was not a leading savant on my own account. When I was offered the chance to lead my own expedition, generously financed, I took it. And so, I later learned, did poor Francis Rudwick, for similar reasons.
You both took the money of the Royal Society's Commission on Free Trade.
Not merely their financing, but their orders, Mr. Fraser. I took 15 men across the American frontier. We dug bones, of course, and we made a great discovery. But we also smuggled guns to the Redskins to help them keep the Yankees at bay. We mapped routes down from Canada, taking the lay of the land in detail. If there's war between Britain and America someday...
Mallory paused.
Well, there's an almighty war in America already, is there not? We are with the Southern Confederates in all but name.
You had no idea that Rudwick might be in danger from these secret activities.
Danger? Of course there was danger, but not at home in England. I was in Wyoming when Rudwick was killed here. I knew nothing of it, till I read of it in Canada. It was a shock to me. I fought bitterly with Rudwick over theory, and I knew he had gone to dig in Mexico, but I didn't know that he and I had the same secret. I didn't know that Rudwick was a commissioned dark lantern man. I only knew that he excelled at our profession.
Mallory sighed on the foul air. His own words surprised him. He had never fully admitted these matters, even to himself.
I rather envied Rudwick, I suppose. He was somewhat my elder, and he was a pupil of Buckland's.
Buckland?
One of the greatest men of our field. He's gone now as well. But truth to tell, I didn't know Rudwick well. He was an unpleasant man, haughty and cold in his relations. He was at his best exploring overseas, at a good distance from decent society.
Mallory wiped the back of his neck.
When I read of his death in a low brawl, I wasn't entirely surprised at the manner of it.
Do you know if Rudwick ever knew Ada Byron?
No, Mallory said, surprised. I don't know. He and I were not that highly placed in savant circles, not at Lady Ada's level, certainly. Perhaps they were introduced, but I think I should have known it, had she favored him.
He was brilliant, you said.
But not gallant.
Fraser changed the subject.
Oliphant seems to believe that Rudwick was killed by the Texians.
I don't know about any Texians, Mallory said angrily. Who knows anything about Texas? A damned wilderness, seas and continents away. If the Texians killed poor Rudwick, I suppose the Royal Navy should shell their ports in reprisal or something of the sort.
He shook his head. The whole foul business, which had once seemed so daring and clever to him, now seemed something inglorious and vile, little more than a low cheat. We were fools to get involved in that commission's work, Rudwick and I. A few rich lords scheming in camera to harass the Yankees. The Yankee republics are already tearing at each other's throats over slavery or provincial rights or some other damned foolishness. Rudwick died because of that, when he might be alive now and digging up marvels. It makes me ashamed.
Some might say it was your patriotic duty, that you did it for the interests of England.
I suppose so, Mallory said, shaking himself. But it's a great relief to speak out on the matter after so long a silence.
Fraser did not seem much impressed by the story. Mallory surmised it was an old and tiresome tale to Inspector Fraser of the Special Branch, or perhaps a mere fragment of larger and more shadowy misdoings. But Fraser did not pursue the matter of politics. He confined himself to the facts of crime.
Tell me about the first attack on your own person.
That came at the Derby. I saw a veiled lady within a hired cab, treated dreadfully by a man and woman, whom I took to be criminals,
the woman being one Florence Russell Bartlett, as I presume you know?
Yes. We are searching most vigorously for Mrs. Bartlett.
I could not identify her male companion, but I may have overheard his name. Swing, or Captain Swing.
Fraser seemed a touch surprised.
Did you tell that fact to Mr. Oliphant?
No.
Mallory, feeling himself on thin ice, said nothing more.
Perhaps that's just as well, Fraser said after a thoughtful pause. Mr. Oliphant's a bit fanciful at times, and Captain Swing is quite a famous name in conspiracy. A mythical personage, much like Ned Ludd or General Ludd. The Swing bands were Luddites of the countryside years ago. Arsonists, mostly. Rick burners. But in the time of troubles, they grew savage and killed a deal of the landed gentry and burned down their fine mansion.
Ah, said Mallory. Do you think this fellow is a Luddite, then?
There are no more Luddites, Fraser said calmly. They're as dead as your dinosaurs. I rather suspect some mischievous antiquary. We have this fellow's description. We have our methods. When we take him, we'll quiz him on his taste in false identities.
Well, this fellow's certainly no rural laborer. He's some sort of Frenchified racetrack dandy. When I defended the lady, he went for me with a stiletto, nicked me in the leg. I suppose I'm lucky that the blade was not venomed.
Perhaps it was, Fraser said. Most poisons are far less potent than the public supposes. Well, I knocked the rascal down and drove them off from their victim. The tout swore twice that he would kill me. Destroy me was the word he used. Then I realized that the lady could be only Lady Ada Byron. She began to talk in a very strange manner, as if drugged or frightened witless. She begged me to escort her to the royal enclosure, but as we approached the royal box, she escaped me by a trick, without so much as a word of thanks for my pains.
Mallory paused, fingering the contents of his pockets. I suppose that's the gist of the matter, sir. Shortly after, I won a good deal of money, wagered on a steam gurney built by a friend of mine. He gave me very useful information, and it changed me in a moment from a modest scholar to a man of means. Mallory tugged his beard. Great as that change has been, it seemed much the lesser wonder at the time.
I see.
Fraser walked on silently. They approached Hyde Park Corner, where men stood on soapboxes, haranguing the crowd and coughing. Fraser and Mallory fell silent as they walked among the clumped and skeptical listeners. They crossed the frantic, crackling bustle of Knightsbridge, Mallory waiting for Fraser to speak, but the policeman said nothing. At the tall iron gates of Green Park, Fraser turned and watched the street behind them for a long moment.
We can cut short through Whitehall, he said at last. I know a back way.
Mallory nodded. He followed Fraser's lead. At Buckingham Palace, the guard was changing. The royal family, as was their habit, were summering in Scotland, but the elite brigade of guards carried out the daily ritual in the Queen's absence. The palace troops proudly marched in the very latest and most efficient British military gear, dun-colored Crimean battle garb, scientifically spattered to deceive the enemy eye. The clever fabric had utterly confused the Russians, by all accounts. Behind the marchers, a team of artillery horses towed a large military calliope, its merry piping and rousing drones sounding strangely forlorn and eerie in the still foul air. Mallory had been waiting for Fraser to reach a conclusion. At last he could wait no longer. Do you believe I met Ada Byron, Mr. Fraser? Fraser cleared his throat and spat discreetly.
Yes, sir, I do. I don't much like the matter, but I don't see much to marvel at in it.
You don't?
No, sir. I believe I see the root of it clear enough. It is gambling trouble. Lady Ada has a modus.
A modus? What is that?
It is a legend in sporting circles, Dr. Mallory. A modus is a gambling system, a secret trick of mathematical enginery to defeat the odds makers.
Every thieving clacker wants a modus, sir. It is their philosopher's stone, a way to conjure gold from empty air.
Can that be done? Is such an analysis possible?
If it is possible, sir, perhaps Lady Ada Byron could do it.
The friend of Babbage, Mallory said. Yes, I can believe it. Indeed I can.
Well, perhaps she has a modus. Perhaps she only thinks she does, Fraser said. I'm no mathematician, but I know there's never been any betting system that worked worth a damn. In any case, she's blundered into something nasty again. Fraser grunted in disgust. She's pursued that clacker's phantom for years now, and rubbed shoulders with very ugly company. Sharpers, low clackers, loan makers, and worse. She's amassed gambling debts, to the point of open scandal. Absently, Mallory hooked his thumbs within his money belt. Well, if Ada's truly found a modus, she won't have debts much longer. Fraser offered Mallory a look of pity for such naivete. A true modus would destroy the institutions of the turf. It would wreck the livelihood of all your sporting gents. Ever seen a track crowd mill up about a Welsher? That's the sort of stir a modus would bring. Your Ada may be a great blue stocking, but she hasn't any more common sense than a housefly. She is a great savant, Mr. Fraser, a great genius. I have read her papers, and the superb mathematics. Lady Ada Byron, Queen of Engines, Fraser said, in an utterly leaden tone that had more weariness than contempt. A strong-minded woman. Much like her mother, eh? Wears green spectacles and writes learned books. She wants to upset the universe and play at dice with the hemispheres. Women never know when to stop. Mallory smiled. Are you a married man, Mr. Fraser?
Not I, Fraser said.
Nor I, not yet. And Lady Ada never married. She was a bride of science.
Every woman needs a man to hold her reins, Fraser said. It's God's plan for the relations of men and women.
Mallory scowled. Fraser saw his look and thought the matter over again. It's evolution's adaptation for the human species, he amended. Mallory nodded slowly. Fraser seemed markedly reluctant to meet Benjamin Disraeli, making some brief excuse about watching the streets for spies, but Mallory thought it far more likely that Fraser knew Disraeli's reputation and did not trust the journalist's discretion, and small wonder. Mallory had met many men of affairs in London, but Dizzy Disraeli was the Londoner's Londoner. Mallory did not much respect Disraeli, but he did find him amusing company. Disraeli knew, or pretended to know, all the backstage intrigues in the Commons, all the rows of publishers and learned societies, all the soirees and literary Tuesdays at Lady So-and-so's and Lady This-and-that's. He had a sly way of alluding to this knowledge that was almost magical. Mallory happened to know that Disraeli had in fact been blackballed at 3 or 4 gentlemen's clubs, perhaps because, although a professed and respectable agnostic, Disraeli was of Jewish descent. But the man's modes and manners somehow left the invincible impression that any Londoner who did not know Dizzy was an imbecile, or moribund. It was like a mystic aura, a miasma that surrounded the fellow, and there were times when Mallory himself could not help but believe it. A female servant in mob cap and apron showed Mallory in. Disraeli was awake and eating his breakfast, strong black coffee and a stinking platter of mackerel fried in gin. He wore slippers, a Turkish robe, and a tasseled velvet fez.
Morning, Mallory. Dreadful morning. Beastly.
It is, rather. Disraeli crammed the last of his mackerel into his mouth and began to stuff the first pipe of the day.
Actually, you're just the fellow I need to see today, Mallory. Bit of a clacker. Technical expert.
Oh?
New damned thing. I bought it just last Wednesday. The shopman swore it would make life easier.
Disraeli led the way into his office, a room reminiscent of Mr. Wakefield's office in the Central Statistics Bureau, though far less ambitious in scale and littered with pipe dottles, lurid magazines, and half-eaten sandwiches. The floor was crowded with carved blocks of cork and heaps of shredded excelsior. Mallory saw that Disraeli had bought himself a Colton Maxwell typing engine and had managed to haul the thing out of its packing crate and set it upright on its curved iron legs. It squatted on the stained oak boards before a patent office chair. "Looks all right," Mallory said. "What is the problem?" "Well, I can pump the treadle, and I can manage the handles well enough," Disraeli said. "I can get the little needle to move to the letters I want, but nothing comes out." Mallory opened the side of the casing, deftly threaded the perforated tape through its gearing spools, then checked the loading chute for the fanfold paper. Disraeli had failed to engage the sprockets properly. Mallory sat in the office chair, foot-pumped the typer up to speed, and grasped the crank handles. "What shall I write? Dictate something." "Knowledge is power," Disraeli said readily. Mallory cranked the needle back and forth through its glass-dialed alphabet. Perforated tape inched out, winding neatly onto its spring-loaded spool, and the rotating printing wheel made a reassuring popping racket. Mallory let the flywheel die down and ratcheted the first sheet of paper out of its slot. KNOWLEDGEEISPPOWER, it said. "Takes a dab hand," Mallory said, handing the page to the journalist. "But you'll get used to it." "I can scribble faster than this," Disraeli complained, "and in a better hand by far." "Yes," Mallory said patiently, "but you can't reload the tape. Bit of scissors and glue, you can loop your punch tape through, and the machine spits out page after page, so long as you push the treadle, as many copies as you like." "Charming," Disraeli said. "And of course you can revise what you've written. Simple matter of clipping and pasting the tape."
"Professionals never revise," Disraeli said sourly. "And suppose I want to write something elegant and long-winded, something such as..."
Disraeli waved his smoldering pipe.
"There are tumults of the mind when, like the great convulsions of nature, all seems anarchy and returning chaos. Yet often, in those moments of vast disturbance, as in the strife of nature itself, some new principle of order, or some new impulse of conduct, develops itself, and controls and regulates, and brings to an harmonious consequence passions and elements which seem only to threaten despair and subversion."
"That's rather good," Mallory said.
"Like it? From your new chapter. But how am I to concentrate on eloquence while I'm pushing and cranking like a washerwoman?"
"Well, if you make some mistake, you can always reprint a new page fresh from the tape."
"They claimed this device would save me paper."
"You might hire a skilled secretary and dictate."
"They said it would save me money as well."
Disraeli puffed at the amber tip of his long-stemmed meerschaum. "I suppose it can't be helped. The publishers will force the innovation on us. Already the Evening Telegraph is setting up entirely with engines. Quite a to-do about it in government. The type-setting brotherhoods, you know."
"But enough shop talk, Mallory. To work, eh? I'm afraid we must hasten. I should like to take notes for at least two chapters today."
"Why?" End of side 5. To continue, turn the cassette over.